Joining me now is a guy by the name of James Ulmer. James has a new book out called The Hollywood Hot List, which is a book version of a list that I understand he's been putting out in Hollywood for several years, all about pretty much every big-time movie star you could name and several who don't quite fit the bill as big-time but still think of themselves as movie stars. James, thanks for coming on with me today.
Thanks, Paul. My pleasure.
Tell me about this list and how long you've been putting it together.
Well, cut to about 10, 12 years ago, I was working at the Hollywood Reporter, and there was just a lot of differences between how, people perceive the stars and what their real value was when you actually go and try to get money based on a name, like, will Tom Cruise raise $100 million or $1 million or $10?
Uh-huh.
And so, when I started doing it, there were no lists in Hollywood. You didn't have the Premier Power List, which I've worked on in the past, and you didn't have the USA Today list. You didn't have the EW, wasn't even there. And inadvertently, we just started this whole sort of phenomenon. And believe me, it was a monster that was left out of a box because I didn't know that it would become as popular in Hollywood. And then about, a year ago or so, New York publishers kind of approached me, and they wanted to try to take it more commercial, and hence this book, which also has some interesting, I think, kind of fun chapters on what it's like to work and live in Hollywood rather than just the list.
Yep, and we're going to get into that in just a couple of minutes, and I want to talk particularly about the perks of these stars as well. That's my favorite part of the book.
Yeah.
But so the Hollywood big shots, the studio heads, the press agents, the publicists, the managers, they all wanted to have copies of this list for several years.
Yeah, I mean, especially the people who buy and sell. And that's the difference of this list, I think, and it took me a long time to get it right, but the thing of this list is that it's put together, it's developed and surveyed by power brokers. In other words, I survey the people who are really at the point of raising money and putting in the stars to the films, and then it's given out or sold to the people who make movies. So it's very much an insider list.
And it's got great information on a lot of these people, including how their career is going, their career trajectory, and you rank them based on their bankability as a box office star.
Yeah, we have something here in California, because we're such a car culture, that's called the Blue Book, which is, what you use to value cars and used cars, and I call this Hollywood Blue Book because it's the used stars. I mean, you have a whole series. I think there's 15 pieces of information on each star, and Paul, most people actually will go, if they want to see a movie, they'll go to Leonard Maltin's video guide, and you'll look at the movies first. But what drives people going to the movies? It is the stars. So this is a book that, for the first time, we wanted to have a guide to the stars that make up almost all of the weekend movies, the commercial movies that people go to see. There's a lot of independent stars here, too, but
right.
There's 200 of the top.
Okay, and who is the top of the top,
creme
de la creme, the number one?
Yes. Well, the women will be happy to hear this. It's Julia Roberts. Unfortunately, and it's the first time a woman has ever become the most powerful actor in the world. I think you'd have to go back to not even in the days of Bette Davis and Joan Crawford to where a woman could actually raise 100% financing. You say Julia Roberts and Julia wants to be in a movie, you don't have to even look at the script. You don't have to know who the co-stars are. You wouldn't even have to have the director. You just say, fine, I'll plunk down $100 million and Julia can do what she wants. Now that's star power.
But how do you know you're not going to end up with Julia Roberts in Mary Riley or one of those period
that
pieces?
Excellent point. You don't. There's no guarantees. And the paradox of lists like this is that, no matter what you give people, nobody can tell what's going to make or break it in Hollywood. Nobody can. This is just a risk assessment technique. I mean, it just tells you what your risks are.
And you base this on their bankability in opening a movie and how much they can get in financing.
Yeah, you base it exactly on box office. You base it on are they willing to travel and promote their films? Because if they're not, it's a global market now, and you have to be successful overseas if you're going to be a successful movie star. And you base it on your professionalism. How reliable are these guys to work with both on and off the set? You could be a monster or you could be, a princess. And there's some people who are both, believe me.
Yeah, let's talk right there about that kind of stuff, because I want to get into these perks, these demands that these movie stars make. And I want to start with one name who made me laugh out loud when I saw the nickname you'd given her. Demi Moore. What is her nickname?
Gimme Moore.
Gimme Moore. Why does she have that nickname? Give me specific stories here, James.
Oh, well, Gimme Moore. Demi Moore. You know, she's one of these people who travels, can't help but travel with these massive entourages. I mean, she could colonize a small African country with the people that she brings along, honestly. And, I mean, I remember one executive calling me up when I was at the Hollywood Reporter. He says, "You're not going to believe this." I said, "What?" He says, "We just turned down Demi Moore, independent film." And I said, "Well, why?" She says, "Well, you know, she wanted to bring along her nannies, her gym trainers, her, you know, her makeup artists, her kids to babysit everybody. She wanted to bring along a couple of her friends, her best friends, the whole entourage package out of a movie that was budgeted for something like $9 million. She had $1 million in perks."
Wow. Wow.
And there are other stories, too. I mean, the classic Demi Moore story is, of course, when they were doing a movie called A Few Good Men. And there's, you know, how every movie has these premieres, and this premiere was going to be in New York, but, of course, Demi was out in Sun Valley, Idaho with her kids. And so how do we get Demi to the premiere? Because, of course, Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson were going to be there. So they said, "Well, you know, we'll fly you out, Demi." And so they had a special, Castle Rock, the movie company behind it, you know, hired a special plane and landed in Sun Valley. Demi went up to the plane, got inside, took one look and said, "Oh, no, this plane won't do." And they said, "What do you mean?" And I heard this from the person who was the production, who was the head of the production. And she said, "Well, look, it doesn't have space for a private suite. It also doesn't have space, more to the point, for all my luggage to be laid flat," because she didn't like to stack it.
Mm-hmm.
So bottom line is, in order to get Demi to the premiere, they had to fly that plane back, bring in another plane, which means you have to pay the pilot, you have to pay for the extra fees, the time, and everything, and just to get Demi to the premiere. And I think they paid a few good bucks for that one. I think they paid about $50,000 to $75,000 extra just for the plane itself,
because she didn't want her luggage stacked vertically. It has to be horizontally, not vertically. And this plane won't do that. And then, of course, if you demand to be flown somewhere, well, once you get there, now you got to put up the pilot and this crew.
Absolutely. And it ain't cheap, I'm telling you. It's you pay for their return trip. They have to be put up in very nice hotels. You have the fuel. For example, John Travolta, when he owns a 727 plane, talk about perks. I mean, when you hire him for a movie, very often you hire his plane so he can go back and forth between the set to his home. Now, that's an easy six-digit fee right there for rental. Well, he'll rent it out to the production company, and they have to pay. But the rumor at one of the major agencies, and it's not something that's confirmed, but it's the people who deal with the contracts, had said that, you know, very often he can charge up to $1 million in plane fuel alone for, I think it was back-to-back films, that was. But, there are these demands that the agents...
Now, wait a second. I just got to stop you, because this is stunning to those of us who don't live in this world. I just want to picture this. John Travolta has made so much money in the movies that he has not just one plane, but he has several planes, one of which is a 727.
A 727, the kind that you and I would take to fly to New York to L.A.
Right, okay. So, and he is a pilot and flies this plane himself, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And when he's going to do a movie, rather than just getting in his plane and flying where he's going like you and I would to get in a car and go to work, he makes the studio lease the plane from him that he owns, that he's going to fly,
yep.
And not only that, but also pay for the fuel.
Yep.
Now
yep.
That,
and pay for the other incidentals, too. I mean, you know, the co-pilot, the stewardess, whatever.
That's power. I'm just making notes here for my next negotiations with Tim Dorsey at the Big 550. I'm talking with James Ulmer. The book is Hollywood Hot List. James, I made it the book of the week on my website, HarrisOnline.com.
Oh, wow, do I have to pay you a percentage for that?
Just the fuel. And I loved reading this. So let's talk more about perks here, because Demi Moore, great story. John Travolta, great. By the way, on the Demi Moore thing, you said she was flown in from Idaho. Nicholson and Cruise were probably flown in first class and put up from wherever they are.
Mm-hmm.
What about, like Kevin Pollak, who was kind of like the fourth star of that, not nearly as well known as the others, or Kiefer Sutherland?
They fly in a regular plane, and if they're lucky, they'll get first class. Sometimes they'll fly them business class. It's all in the negotiation, Paul. I mean, this is all done by agents, and when you accept a role for a film, never mind how much it costs just to be able to bid for a film. But, you know, when you accept and the star says yes, the first thing, and even before the deal is signed, you know, the agent will go in and say, okay, now he needs a trailer this size. He'll need, you know, he'll need a masseur on the set. He'll need a massage table with Evian access, or he'll need, you know, a satellite TV in his trailer. And sometimes they'll say exactly what channels, and he'll need internet access, whatever. He'll need his, for example, Woody Harrelson, God forbid you don't keep his refrigerator stacked with wheatgrass juice.
You know, I'm the same way. If I don't get my wheatgrass juice every day, James, I can't do the show.
Yeah, well, there you go. You and I'll set you up with Woody. I'm telling you, it's comic. You know, you have to laugh at it because, you know, I think of it like a Fellini film. It's just, it's surreal. But you know what the paradox of all this is? I mean, the kicker is that these actors are all, and I'm not denigrating actors. I adore some of them, but they're all so earnest and desperate to be loved and worshipped and adored, and to have, you know, their name and a legacy for the rest of time, that they would do most of these films for free if they had to.
Yeah.
We pay them $20 million, and they do it for nearly free, and that's the kick in the ass.
And still, they get to make these huge demands, which is really what I think is shocking to most people. Now, there must be people in Hollywood who are not like this. I'll give you a name here, for instance. I would guess that Meryl Streep is not a demanding person.
No, not at all.
Like she,
Meryl is somebody who will go on a set, and where she'll be demanding is strictly in the most professional of ways. For example, if she needs, Meryl doesn't need to do more than one take, rarely more than two. And if the scene isn't working after two takes, she'll turn to the director and she'll say, you know, what seems to be the problem here? What's not working? And because, you know, she has so much of her knowledge and her presence available and can call on that and focus so intently that she gets it right in two takes. That's, you know, and frankly, when a star of that caliber comes on a set, it brings up the level of not only the other actors but the other crew. Kristen Scott Thomas is another example. Ian McKellen, all of these class acts, Dame Judi Dench. It's magnificent to watch them because how it changes this tribal working relationship that happens on the set of a on the floor of a set, which is, you know, can be anything. It can be anything from a raucous kindergarten room where the director has no control to something that's just magical and extremely efficient and very, very, you know, high quality, which is the best of Hollywood has that.
Now, when I think of stars like that, Meryl Streep, on the male side, I would think that Robert De Niro would be very much the same way.
Yeah, Bobby is. He can be, you know, he can have his temper. I mean, the thing about De Niro is he's a brilliant, brilliant actor, but he's kind of king of the perks, speaking of perks.
Oh, really?
Oh, my gosh. I'll tell you one quickie about when he was in Cannes at the big hotel there that put people up is called the Hotel du Cap. And he was there promoting a Guilty by Suspicion, but as I say in the book, he was kind of guilty only of uncorking huge bills, champagne bills for his entourage.
Wow.
One of which was $36,000.
Whoa!
At the end of one entourage dinner. And, of course, the distributor has to pay that.
$36,000 in champagne at one dinner?
Yeah, well, the dinner and champagne for his entourage.
Wow!
Yeah, for the bill at the Du Cap. Now, the Du Cap, mind you, Paul, is one of the most expensive hotels in the world. You can't pay in credit card, you can only pay in cash, and it's $2,000 minimum a night. You lay that down in green bills. You don't. They will not accept. They will not accept credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
It's where Madonna stays. It's where.
I've got a place there.
You've got a little hideaway in the back.
Yeah,
I hear.
I can't afford the sand on the beach there. Who are we kidding? I'm talking with James Ulmers. The book is Hollywood Hot List, a great book about every major star you could name and many people who wouldn't qualify as major stars. You mentioned the word Evian a few minutes ago, and I got to ask you about a story I heard several years ago about Kim Basinger.
Oh, yes, you're washing your hair in it.
Yeah, is this true?
Yep. Oh, yeah, that was very, very true. And, I mean, obviously things can get blown out of proportion.
Okay, so what's the real story there?
No, the real story was that she had ordered up about a box or a crate, you know, at least I think there was about 20, Evian water bottles in the box, and she ordered up to do her hair because she thought the water was too hard in the place she was staying. I can't remember right now where it was.
And did the movie company have to pay for that?
Of course. Of course. I mean, this is that's considered a small perk, you know, for a movie company. I mean, when the expensive perks come when a star... whoever it is, you know, and Warner Brothers is famous for this, you know, they will even have their absurdly small objects put on a plane to be flown from, let's say, the home of the star to whatever set. Let's say they're in the mountains of Montana and they're shooting and the star lives in New York City, you know. I mean, I've known examples where the star will have their pet. You know, they'll put Mr. Pet on the jet, fly the jet to the set, and then the pet and the jet are met by a vet, you know? It's like a Dr. Seuss farce, you know? I mean, my God, it's worse than Green Eggs and Ham. It just boggles the mind, you know, that, and yet the studios do it because, look, I mean, from their point of view, hey, if they put bums on seats, I pay Tom Hanks or Tom Cruise $20 million, if I can make money off that, an extra $50 million, it's, you know, I'll pay him the $20 million.
Tell me another pet story, but use a name. Give me a specific example of a good pet story, because I love that, pets and jets and vets and all the rest.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one more, and this is one of the classics. I only found this out. Somebody told this to me in the middle of an emergency stopped elevator, but there's a... not a big star. She was, you know, Kirstie Alley.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you this one. Kirstie is a noted animal lover, and during the making of a movie called Sibling Rivalry, which came out some years ago.
By the way, before you go on with the story, has she ever been in a hit movie except for that one with Travolta, Look Who's Talking?
No. I haven't tracked her. I mean, I couldn't tell you exactly what she's been in recently, but no, she kind of had she fell off the curve, which is part of the problem of being an older woman in Hollywood as well. It's not just Kirstie's problem.
Right.
Very hard for them to keep it.
Because she's not even in your top 200 list here.
No. And keep in mind, there's probably 1,200 people that could be called by the layman a star in Hollywood. But it's really only the top 200 that count.
Okay, so Kirstie Alley, a star, but I want to hear about this perk. Go ahead.
Yeah, so she's going, you know, there's a press junket for this movie called Sibling Rivalry. And, of course, they wanted to come to it because it's how you get the media out. And she said, well, that's fine, but I only have one little problem. And they said, what's that? She said, well, I have a pet. It needs to be taken care of. And they said, well, fine, what kind of pet? She says, it's a baby possum. She says, okay, so we'll babysit the possum. She says, well, it's not quite that simple. She says, there's this possum needs to be breastfed. It's a baby possum, and, you know, I tried bottle feeding this creature, and it just wouldn't work. So she told the head of publicity at the studio that, and this was the demand she made.
Wait a second. Had she, after the bottle feeding hadn't been working, had she been breastfeeding this possum herself?
She had tried, and she had indeed been doing that. I'm, you know, at the risk of hopefully not offending some people out in the audience. So she had demanded, and this is absolutely true, that the studio, if she was going to come out and do the press junket, would actually hire a lactating human female to wet nurse this baby possum while she was doing.
Oh, sure. You look for that every day. That's in the classifieds.
Yeah, right.
It's in the back, you know. It's in the in search of, you know, single white female currently lactating looking for a possum.
She was keeping abreast of the situation. So the point is, and she, in another sense, she was playing possum. I mean, she would say no media for the movie, no publicity for the picture.
Don't tell me the studio went along with this.
The studio not only went along with it, they paid $1,000 a day for a volunteer. A lady who had just given birth to go and breastfeed this baby possum.
Not a volunteer. She was paid, wasn't she?
Yes. I mean, but my God, that's true. I mean, I can't imagine that anybody would do it without getting paid, actually.
So they found a woman who would breastfeed Kirstie Alley's baby possum while she went off and did her movie.
I can't give you a weirder story than that.
I mean,
of all the stories I've heard over 10 years, that's one of the weirdest.
Talking with James Ulmers, who's got a new book out called Hollywood Hot List, which is the first book version of a list that he's actually been putting together for years. He created something called the Ulmer Scale to rank movie stars and not-so-big stars on bankability and professionalism and talent and career management and willingness to travel and promote. He's got all sorts of inside dirt on lots of them. And I'm just going to throw some names out here, and if you've got stories about them or just want to tell me what you think of how their careers are going, James, you give me whatever you got here. The Grinch movie's opening up today. How about Jim Carrey? He's got to be at the top of his game these days.
Yeah, Carrey definitely is somebody who is, first of all, he's a major, major star because he's so physical in his comedy. And, you know, you go to press junkets, and he will do entire shticks and scenes and do whole little kind of mini plays for you, just almost like Laurel and Hardy stuff that you just, you know, the public will never see. I mean, he's very smart. He'll do a smaller film than a big one for the studios. It's kind of the Clint Eastwood strategy of keeping your, you know, brand awareness high.
Right.
And the French, it took a long time to warm up to Carrey. You know, they still, that's probably the hardest place that he has to still conquer. But the problem with Carrey has always been that Hollywood rarely supports him in anything serious. You know, he was really pissed off that he didn't get an Oscar nomination for The Truman Show. I mean, they, you know, a lot of these people just want to see him act the clown. And I'm disappointed, you know, that they haven't, because I think he does have some real talent. But again, he knows where his market is, and he's exploiting it, and that's why he's as big as he is.
I agree with you. I thought he was terrific in The Truman Show and deserved to at least get a nomination for that. Let's throw some more names out here. Mel Gibson.
Well, Mel's a guy that, you know, he's a devout Catholic, has a family of five. He's not one of those people who's been sucked up by the star machine. He's a great practical jokester. You know, he'll, I think for one movie with Jodie Foster, you know, he had hundreds and hundreds of birds let out as a joke. I can't remember the exact context of it, but you know, when you're on a Mel Gibson set, you may be, and you probably will be, the victim of a big practical joke. He's one of those guys that can still reel in this young woman demographic. He's a consummate professional, completely able to deal with success, and he's a guy you just want to hang out with. There's really not a bad thing to say about him.
All right. Now, speaking of big-time movie stars.
Well, I would say one thing, though, just really quickly, yeah. Paul. He desperately wanted Robin Williams' role in Good Will Hunting, and he lobbied for it, but they gave it to Robin Williams, which is interesting.
I can't see Mel Gibson in that role.
I can't either, but he wanted it. He loved the play.
All right, talking about mega movie stars, global movie stars, Tom Cruise is at the top of the list.
Yeah, I've been down with Tom. He's one of the ones that I've actually had the privilege of knowing, because we did a junket down in the Amazon once. And Tom is a super nice guy.
What's his reputation,
though? Well, his reputation among crew members, his reputation isn't as squeaky clean as you might think. Tom is somebody who goes to a great distance to protect his image. He, on the set, he can, you know, he can take a lot of takes. He can has a hard time remembering his lines, and frankly, you get complaints from some people about where he parks his trailer. Now, there's a little politics in movie making that goes along with working with the crews, and that is when people go out on location, they park the camera trucks first, closest to the set, because there's all that heavy equipment to lug. Tom, and then comes the stars' trailers. It's common courtesy. It's kind of the rule of the game. Tom, in several movies, including Born on the 4th of July, would park his star trucks in front of the camera trucks, forcing the people to lug their camera equipment all the further. And a lot of crew people complain about that. They'll say, well, you know, what's the matter? Can't Tom, you know, take his Evian water, you know, a little further?
Yeah, he'd have to walk, what, 30 more feet?
Yeah. And, you know, there's lots of things with his image that he controls very tightly. He doesn't want the rest of the world to know about.
Now, what about his wife, Nicole Kidman?
Nicole Kidman, she is I'd fear Nicole a lot more than I'd fear Tom. She is a real crackerjack professional, and she controls his life. I mean, Nicole is somebody who, you know, really plans out the days. She's really the person who heads up that family. She's kind of a fun ditz. She's got this image of a kind of ice goddess of the north when she goes on press junkets and stuff. But really, she's just a crazy, you know, classy crazy ditz. I remember one time she had to go out to a press meeting, and she couldn't find her hair extension. hair extensions, and so she just, for the photo call, so yep. She just threw her hair under a baseball cap and ran out to meet the press, and she's cool that way.
And she probably looked fantastic.
Oh, she did. I mean, you know, it's like Halle Berry. There's a woman that can roll out of bed, and she looks fabulous, you know. She's
Wait a minute. I'm just going to picture that for just a second. Okay, I'm back now. Now, in the Tom Cruise story, you were mentioning trailers. I'm guessing that how big your trailer is and where it is a big deal for these stars.
Yeah, these trailers are called Winnies in Hollywood. You know, Winnebago's uh-huh. short for. And, you know, they have something called the Winnie Wars. And, you know, these guys are measuring how big your Winnie is next to mine. And I do
size
want to say
matters,
Winnie
huh?
is a trailer, Paul.
Size matters, I guess.
Size matters. I mean, Tobey Maguire, here's a kid who, I mentioned this briefly in the book, but, I mean, you know, he was starring with Charlize Theron in something called Cider House Rules.
Oh, good movie.
And, you know, he really ticked off the studio honchos because he was caught with a measuring tape in hand, actually measuring the length of Charlize Theron's trailer as opposed to his. Well, Harvey Weinstein, who's the head of Miramax, got so pissed off with that kind of behavior that he basically read Toby the Riot Act. And, you know, Toby then behaved. But, I mean, a lot of people will do it. I mean, I think Michael Keaton was known to do it, you know, in another movie that Melanie Griffith was on.
Was that Pacific Heights?
And he complained
Heights?
That Melanie Griffith had a chef included with her trailer, and he didn't.
But she had a chef, and he didn't, and so...
yeah, it's crazy, and she was using Don Johnson's trailer from Miami Vice.
And when somebody complains like that, what do they say? They say, I'm not going to come out of my trailer, I'm not
going to
do the
scene?
Well,
I mean, there are lots of stories about not coming out of trailers. I mean, you know, if you don't come out of trailers for too long, they'll sick the union on you. I mean, there's lots of stories about how some producers have actually gotten union honchos to come down and demand that these stars come out of their trailers. But, yeah, I mean, what they'll do is they'll, you know, what difference does it make? 21-foot trailer, an 18-foot trailer. When you're on vacation, on location, sometimes the only trailer you can find is, it says in their contact, 21 feet or 18 feet, and maybe you can only find a 5-foot trailer.
That will not be acceptable to Mr. Snipes or whoever it is who's inside
you know,
there.
It's the whole thing is this image game, this very, very competitive image game, which in the end, it's a culture that just fosters that kind of intense competition because, you know, Hollywood's a town based on a lot of fear and desperation.
Talking with James Ulmers, the book is called The Hollywood Hot List, and it's out now in bookstores and the book of the week on my website, harrisonline.com. We're here on the Big 550 KTRS talking about big movie stars. Now, here's a name of somebody who was big because of one movie and has been writing it ever since. And I don't think that this woman is all that talented or deserves any of the praise that she gets. But still, I guess she's still got that goddess thing going in Hollywood. I'm talking about Sharon Stone.
You happen to mention the that's the red flashing light right there.
Really?
Let me tell you, there's two people in Hollywood after I did, I don't know, 3 or 4 months of research on this, you know, on the sets, off the sets, et cetera, in the offices. You know, there's two people whose names comes up. On the women's side, that's the most difficult actors to work with. The woman's side, it would have to be Sharon Stone. On the men's side, it would have to be Val Kilmer. Now, Sharon is somebody who started out as, you know, in steamy erotic thrillers.
Yep.
And grade B, but that's how she got to be an international success, because those kind of movies travel all over the world.
Yep.
Certainly don't need a lot of language to earn subtitles to understand those.
Right.
So, you know, and she had a few lucky breaks, and then Basic Instinct happened. And Sharon's problem is that she's just incredibly difficult to work with by almost anyone. You hear, you know, mention Sharon Stone's name and you'll hear tales of betrayal and vengeance and jealousy and conspiracy. And I don't use those terms lightly. I mean, there's lots of producers who just won't work with her. Now, on the other side of the coin, she's, you know, very helpful with the AIDS, you know, and charitable situations, and that's the image that has been marketed very well. But on the set, you know, you go up to, and she'll be one of those people who, if she's not in a good mood, she'll have the little guy fired. I mean, she can go and say, you know, the guy, I remember somebody telling me, the little guy who did the mark for Where People Make Their Mark, she didn't like something about him, and in one of the movies, she took care of that. Now, there's a classic story about Sharon, but I don't know if I should tell it.
Yes, you should.
Yeah. Oh, God. Sure. Well, there was this movie, and this just goes to show, you know, how much Hollywood, how, you know, loves Sharon Stone. I'm being facetious. There was this movie called Diabolique that she was in.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a shower scene in the movie. And, of course, they had set up a set so that there was this big bathtub above the shower when they were shooting on the soundstage.
Wait. Why is there a bathtub above the...
Because that's where the water's going to be held for the shower.
It's not a real shower.
No, it's not a real shower. It's in a studio.
Okay.
And so they took a break. The actors, the crew and the director took a break. And they went off to a pub and they came back. And they were ready to shoot the scene where Sharon goes into it and takes a shower. And the stand-in did the lights and everything. Well, the crew, you know, went upstairs. And people were wondering why they were taking so long. Well, it turned out that this crew had gone and gotten a few beers into them and actually peed into the tank where Sharon was going to shower.
Aha!
And she actually showered.
Oh, she didn't know, of course.
And she didn't even know. Well, she later found out even the director peed in the tank. And I am telling you, moral of this story was simply this. Sharon, you've pissed on us enough. Now we're going to piss on you. I kid you not.
Oh, that's great.
Welcome to Hollywood.
This
is the stuff that you don't see on the front cover, fluff stories that they do in Premiere Magazine or whatever.
Oh, that is a great story. Now, is there one equally as good about Val Kilmer, who
was
the male?
Well, not equally as good. somehow the women always get the best stories. But, Val is just somebody who has brought grown women down to their knees and crying. I mean, you know, his agent at CAA is very, very, was before she became working with, went to work with Tom Cruise, was very, very tough. And he's just, as somebody said, he's just a very, very unhappy, and very abusive guy. I mean, Val is somebody who, I think somebody said he has the charm of a snail. But, he's a detriment when it comes to putting him on the road and you travel, traveling with him. People just say you're better off saying don't come.
Yeah.
He's impetuous. He'll agree to something and then want to change it. Keep in mind, I'm not trying to dish these actors. What I try to do is just, what are these people, what are people talking about who work with him on the set? What's really being said about these people? And, there's good and the bad in all of these guys. He's... on some movies, he's impossible. On some movies, he's just fine. But I think with Val, he tries to intellectually, challenge his producer and director to get control rather than to get what's best for the film. I know he's had at least one director fired on the island of Dr. Moreau.
You know, this doesn't surprise me. He seems like that kind of guy. This is a guy whose public image I don't think is that great. I don't think people think, Val Kilmer must be a great guy. But I'll tell you who I think does have that kind of image. I was watching Letterman a few nights ago, and he had Samuel L. Jackson on there.
Samuel's great.
And he just seems like a guy who you'd love to hang out with, and I know he loves to play golf. I mean, what could be better than spending 4 hours on a golf course playing 18 holes with Samuel L. Jackson?
Yeah, no, Sam's great. He's kind of an interestingly dangerous actor. But I think the funny thing about him is that he's one of these guys that doesn't do a lot of star perks. He doesn't like them. On the other hand, and in fact, he is at most usually has one assistant. But there has been a couple of movies where he's actually paid and brought in two very pricey hairdressers, even though he had a shaved, bald head. and they were very expensive for the film to have to actually put in. But, the thing about him is that he travels and promotes everything.
Yeah.
He's like a 9 out of 10 in that regard, and I can't tell you how important that is for actors. I mean, Jodie Foster does that. She speaks French to the French distributor. Sandra Bullock knows German because she grew up in Germany. And, Germany's the number one international market in the world.
So Sandra Bullock must be huge there.
Yeah. Well, Bullock's much bigger there proportionally than she is in the States. And the thing of the matter is that, it's surprising as it may sound, about 65%, 60 to 65% of all the revenues for all the movies in Hollywood comes from overseas, not from North America. So unless these guys go out and press the flesh and flush out the stories and the people and really talk to the distributors and the people who are making their careers, you know, they're gonna suffer for it later. They're going to have shorter career arcs.
We were talking about Samuel L. Jackson. Let me mention somebody who I think wants to be Samuel L. Jackson but never will be, Wesley Snipes.
Wesley has just, I think he dug his own grave in that regard. I mean, there's an interesting story, I think it is, about Wesley. Yes, it is. It's, he's somebody who I think was up for the movie Shaft.
Oh, Samuel L. Jackson got the role.
Yep, that was produced by a legendary producer called Scott Rudin, and so the story is that I think that Wesley shows up at Rudin's office with his posse. I mean, this is when he wanted the role.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a posse of about 10 people, and he apparently won't take his shades off during the meeting, and which, of course, pissed Rubin off immediately.
Yeah.
And the first thing he does, he insists that on all these script changes or he won't do the film, and Rudin gets so angry that he throws Snipes out of the office and hires Sam Jackson instead, who is much more pleasant.
Yes.
And that's just a minor thing, but I think, this kind of attitude thing, it's got to stop.
Yeah. Now, I got to ask you about people in Hollywood with a reputation who are just trouble. And I mean, we don't even have to go to Robert Downey Jr., but I'm just thinking, you know, like Charlie Sheen.
But Robert Downey Jr., just to put a parenthesis there, Paul.
Okay.
Robert Downey Jr. is somebody who, yes, has been, you know, done his time in jail, and he can be trouble with a capital T, and that rhymes with P, but you talk to people who work with him on the set, and you look at his professionalism ratings for just behaving on the set, and people adore him because he's one of those actors who will actually, for example, when you do a movie and you're shooting what they call two-shot scene, you know, they have, you're saying a line and then it's dialogue and you cut to the other person saying it. When they're shooting that person saying his line to the other person usually isn't even on the set. You know, they can do that later. But Robert is somebody who will always come to the set and read lines off camera, even if he's not going to be shot, just to help the other actor.
Wow.
So he's a good guy. Robin Williams will do that, too.
And I got to say, the way when he played Charlie Chaplin in the Chaplin movie,
right.
Robert Downey Jr. was amazing. He nailed that role, and he was amazing. But what about a guy like Charlie Sheen?
Oh, Charlie Sheen. Well, Charlie Sheen is somebody who, he can be difficult, demanding, but he's very much, supports his friends on the set, and he can actually make demands that'll say, look, if you hire me, I want you to hire this guy and, you know, help give him a break or something. I think there was a story about Charlie Sheen in a movie called, I think, Major League 2 or something like that, and he was practicing at the Hotel du Cap, that hotel that costs so much money in Cannes.
Yes.
And, you know, he's trying to play this, play the pitcher in
the
that
wild
movie.
Thing.
What? Wild Thing.
Yeah.
That's right. You got it. And so he took all these ashtrays to practice. You know, his room was looking out over the ocean, and there were some rocks by the ocean right outside his window. And he would try to hit a rock with these ashtrays, which, of course, only cost $30 a piece. So he is throwing these ceramic ashtrays at the rock, of course, missing it most of the time from what the sources said.
Uh-huh.
Of course, he lived up to his role. But, I mean, that definitely hurled an extra, you know, few thousand dollars onto his extras bill at the hotel.
Unbelievable. I've only got another minute or two with James Ulmer here, so I got to ask you about huge movie star and probably a nice guy, but I don't know what his reputation is like on the set. But another guy you'd just like to hang out with, Tom Hanks.
Oh, Tom Hanks is great. Tom Hanks is somebody who will go the extra mile. For example, I'll just give you really quickly. You know, his manager was very sensitive when he did Philadelphia, and he did a couple of, after that he was asked to do a documentary about a gay topic as well, which was called The Celluloid Closet. And his closet, the lawyer didn't want him to do any more stuff after Philadelphia like that, but Tom said yes, drove himself to the set, didn't want any hair or makeup. He even said thank you to the crew. That's the guy that Hollywood loves.
Mm-hmm.
He's planned his career really carefully. But I'll tell you, on the opposite side of things, really quickly, Paul, Hollywood looks at these stars as commodities. They're marketed as commodities, like it or not. They're measured, tracked, priced, compared. It's really not much different than soup cans. And the thing about Tom is that from a strictly marketing point of view, if you look at the cynical side of Hollywood, the reason why Tom is so valuable is because he's, as somebody said to me, he said, you know, he's bland, easy on the taste buds, and not offensive to anyone, a perfect marketing tool. And that's a quote-unquote. He's like, the guy said, he's like what McDonald's is to hamburgers, Tom Hanks is to acting.
Oh, I don't think that's
true. No, I don't think it's true either. But you see what how Hollywood can niche these people in. They know that Tom is like the Jimmy Stewart of today. He's much loved, he's very well liked, and he's a fine actor. And he appeals to a broad demographic.
Yep.
And Hollywood, on one side, will support that, but this whole marketing game, I'm telling you, it's a very, very big, big machine. And it's frightening on some sides and hilarious on the other.
James, I could go on all day talking to you and getting stories like these. They're great. The book is called James Ulmer's Hollywood Hot List, the complete guide to star ranking, and not just ranking them, but great stories about them and about how things really work inside Hollywood. We'll talk again sometime. I appreciate your
great,
time today.
Paul, thanks for the time.